This is Yawa Radio.
A warm welcome to the Yawa Radio podcast. The Yawa Radio podcast is an opportunity again to listen to one of our inspirational, thought-provoking interviews that we have brought to the listeners of Yawa Radio. Yawa Radio is online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We are your well-being and happiness radio station, bringing the feel-good feeling to every single day of the week. Check us out at yawaradio.co.uk. Now sit back and enjoy this podcast from the Yawa Radio team.
Welcome to Jordan Space. Every fortnight, you can join me, your host, Steve Phillip, alongside Danielle and Paul from the Jordan Legacy team, together with some very special guests for an hour of conversation, music, and above all, hope. Welcome to Jordan Space. This show does discuss themes of suicide, and we'd encourage you to take care of yourself by stepping away from the show at any point, should you find the content triggering or uncomfortable to listen to. For support, please visit our website, thejordanlegacy.com, and our help menu options. Welcome to Jordan Space. I'm your host, Steve Phillip, and I'm joined, as usual, by my regular co-hosts, Danny and Paul. Welcome to you both. During today's show, we'll be speaking with Melanie Costas, founder and CEO of Rural Mental Health Matters. Melanie will be talking about her work with this social enterprise and also about living with physical disability for many years and how her experience of being diagnosed with breast cancer also severely impacted her mental health. Paul, our conversation with Melanie is going to touch on a couple of the pieces in the puzzle we include in the Jordan Legacy's report, Moving Towards a Zero Suicide Society. The first of these pieces is support with long-term physical health issues. How does this relate specifically to suicide prevention?
It's a key issue. It's a key piece in the puzzle. We all know that there is this problem that we have that people think that suicide and mental health are synonymous, and suicide has many, many different factors involved, different causes, contributing factors. It's not just about mental health. And in a lot of cases, it's got nothing to do with mental health at all, really. And this is a good example. There are some people who live with long-term physical health conditions, and in some cases, chronic pain from lots of different causes. And they try and deal with it, and they try and medicate, and they try everything, you know, and physio and chiro and every bit of treatment that's available. But they find themselves living in what they think is unbearable pain a lot of the time. And it wears people down. A lot of older people get to the point, like we had Ellie on the show previously talking about this with her dad. People just get to the point where, you know, they think, what's the point carrying on, really?
I think it's really important. And also your reference back to our previous show with Ellie Hatto. I think for anyone listening to the show, I'd really strongly recommend listening to show 35, where we talk about assisted suicide and voluntary assisted dying as well. Paul, the second piece in the puzzle I'd like to ask you about is appropriate, accessible mental health services. How does this affect how we get the numbers of suicides on a downward trend towards zero?
Another really key piece of the puzzle, another serious issue. We've all heard recently about these ridiculously long waiting lists, people trying to get access, people who need mental health services, who need treatment, who've actually been referred by their GPs, and they're on a six-month waiting list or longer in some cases. And sometimes they're on a three-month waiting list for assessment. It's just ridiculous. I mean, the whole system is completely broken. So we respond to that in different ways. Some people go around, and I'm going to say slightly controversial thing here, perhaps, but a lot of suicide prevention advocates and campaigners actually do a lot of harm sometimes when they relate. They say that suicide is a mental health issue, so that's the first problem. And then they say, we need more money to go into the National Health Service. It's all about getting more money to the National Health Service, but it's really not as simple as that, because it's about getting the right services to people. And a lot of people go into the mental health system and go into psychiatric care are damaged by their experience of going into the mental health system. I spoke to somebody recently who had an eating disorder and was admitted to a general psych ward in Liverpool and was traumatized by the experience of being on a general psych ward. It didn't help with her eating disorder. It didn't help with her mental health at all. So one of the things that I often have this conversation with people, how do we get better assessment in the community so people don't have to go into the mental health system to be assessed, to be sent back out into the community, damaged people. So yeah, we should have more assessment in the community. And those who really do need NHS mental health services should have access to it immediately when they need it.
As you rightly say, it's not just a case of pumping more money into the existing system as it is, because, you know, for many people, they will say that that is a broken system. We need change, as you rightly said. Danny, Melanie will be giving insights into mental health and suicide prevention from the perspective of people living in rural areas. There are lots of differences by area, aren't there, Danny?
Yeah, that's right. ONS statistics show that suicide rates do differ by area. For example, the North East suicide rate is twice that of London. And this is why the national strategy has its limitations, because each area can have its own local issues. For example, you've got socioeconomic disadvantage, you know, where you've got poor housing, deprivation, lack of employment, and so on. And these are all issues that can affect people and play a part in suicidal thoughts and actions. And then, you know, you have the issue of the support services that are available will differ by area. So those struggling with mental health issues or those who need support for suicide bereavement might not be able to get the help they need. And as we know, it's often those with lived experience, especially those bereaved by suicide, that set up local tailored services. Like we know about Debbie Rogers, that has set up Sean's Place in Liverpool, and also teenager Alfie, who with his mum has set up Alfie's Squad after he lost his dad to suicide when he was just 8 years old. They support children bereaved by suicide. And we know that through our work at the Dual Legacy that services such as these can hugely benefit the areas that they're in and can really make a difference to people's lives.
Well, look, thank you both. A really interesting conversation to kickstart our show today before we speak with Melanie. Let's take a break now and listen to the second of five tracks chosen by Melanie Kostas this week. And we're going to be chatting with her very shortly after we listen to Soul to Soul and Keep On Moving.
This is Yawa Radio.
Join me, Holly Jean Jackson, for Inspiration Contagion, weekdays at 5 p.m., when I am joined by inspirational guests sharing their inspirational stories.
Welcome back. Our guest on this week's Jordan Space is Melanie Kostas, founder and CEO of the social enterprise Rural Mental Health Matters, which aims to ensure that mental and physical health is more visible, inclusive, and more equitable for all individuals living in some of the least accessible parts of the country. Welcome to the show, Melanie. I'm going to start with a question that you must be asked every time you appear on an interview. You're known as the pink-haired warrior. And looking at you here, which our listeners can't see, of course, I can see why. But for any of our listeners who haven't met you before, can you explain how that name came about?
That actually was one of my dear friends, Dr. Noopi Arora. She gave me that name because she said that it really suited what I do. So I'm always campaigning for and advocating for and support for mental and physical health. And the pink hair came about because after I had a breakdown in March 2021, I decided I was going to go pink. And I haven't looked back.
Well, look, we're going to talk about that part of your life as well during the show today. And living with long-term physical ill health is also something that you've experienced. Would you be happy to talk about that part of your journey first?
I get sort of people say to me, well, you don't look disabled, or, oh, you poor thing is another one, or you're too young to have a stick. Lots of ableist comments that people mean well, but they are really not very helpful. So I was born with a disability called Bertolotti syndrome. When I was a child, I was a gymnastic and a horse rider. So I was very flexible, super flexible, but obviously to the detriment when I got older. Now, Bertolotti syndrome in itself isn't normally diagnosed until you're a lot older. And I was in my late 30s when I first started getting spinal problems. So what that means is that my hip bone is sort of fused at the bottom to my vertebrae, my last vertebrae, which means that my back is out of alignment all the time. So I've actually got 9/10 degenerative discs in my back that cause me quite a lot of issues with my mobility and pain. And that's quite challenging in itself. And then the other issues that come alongside that is that I've got something called HEDS, which is hypermobility LSD syndrome, where you're too flexible, which then links in, doesn't it, to me being a gymnast when I was a child and super flexible. and the two are quite often linked up. So what that means in general living is that my legs are prone to collapse. So it's like somebody's hit the back of my knee, and I never know when that's going to happen. So that's quite fun, especially if you're in the aisle in Tesco's where there's the alcohol and also spasms, like I've been plugged into the electric socket sometimes. So it's tickle. I was on lots and lots of painkillers, and coming off those was almost as bad as the pain. I live daily with pain, and I haven't had a day since March 2008 when all of it started with her back pain.
Now, as if experiencing the physical illnesses that you've had, to add to that, you were diagnosed with cancer.
At the end of August 2020, I found a lump. This was because I had an itch on the side of my right breast that wouldn't go away. I actually was in with the GP really quickly, but because it was lockdown, the worst part was going to the GP surgery and having to speak outside to a tannoy. Anyway, the receptionist was very good. They let me in. Doctors sent me for the fast track referral. Yeah, it turns out that it was cancer, so I made the decision to have the mastectomy, but I remember coming back from the hospital and there was a song playing and I was crying. But I think the shock of it all didn't register with my brain for some time, and that's quite common. I read that quite a high percentage of people that are diagnosed with cancer are subsequently diagnosed with PTSD.
That's a question we'll come, and thank you for sharing that. I mean, clearly very emotional for you to describe this now, still not surprising at all given what you went through.
Did you get any support, Melanie, after you'd gone through the cancer and had the mastectomy? Did you have any therapy or anything like that?
I didn't get offered anything. There was nothing from the start to when I had the mastectomy to treatment to after. So when I got the diagnosis, I actively sought out Macmillan, who told me you get 6 weeks BUPA counselling free. None of this was told to me. This is one of the reasons why I just finished working with Pfizer on their Cancer Insight Panel, which is a global first for the UK, because there isn't any mental health support. It's probably the biggest thing that's going to happen to you physically and mentally in your life, and yet there's nothing mandatory. So in answer to your question, I sought out support. So initially I got 6 weeks counselling, which I think all I did was cry over the phone with BUPA. And that kind of steadied me while I was on a waiting list for counselling with a local charity. Actually, there isn't any in Dorset that I knew about. The nearest one to me was in Somerset, about 15 miles away in Frome. And that's the cancer charity called We Hear You, and they were phenomenal. But without that, I don't know how I would have coped.
Thanks, Melanie, for sharing that. You've touched on a really important subject that we've been covering as part of our Zero Suicide Society programme. And we've covered on this radio show programme as well with previous guests, that issue around communication within the NHS and the damage that it does when the communication is so poor, mm-hmm. and the lack of appreciation of the mental health aspect of it. So their obsession with physical health and not understanding the mental health, you know, so that I've had this with my family, with our son as well, when he had his brain tumour surgery, you know, just that throwaway line about, you know, well, we thought we'd get 90% of the tumour out, but we've got 50% out, so you'll just have to have another operation, you know.
Yeah,
as if it's not understanding the damage that does. And I can only imagine if somebody didn't have your mental health knowledge at that stage, what they might have been going through at that point.
Exactly that. That's what I was thinking. And that's why I campaign so much about getting mental health support. I've asked for it to be on the fast track letter so that when the letter comes out to people, if the GP suspects that, just to explain to people what happens, if you find something, generally the way in is you go to your GP. The GP then decides whether they think it's cancer or not. They err on the side of caution, so they generally will send people for what's called a fast track appointment. That letter comes through and you should get an appointment within 14 days. On that letter is the ideal opportunity to have even the national numbers and the Hub of Hope, which would be great, for you to get help if you need it. So that when you're going through this mental health whirlwind. I mean, it's like a roller coaster. It's horrendous without any safety strap. You think, hold on a minute, there's something on that letter, and then you can go back to it.
Yeah.
You don't have to have a book on it with all the ins and outs of what may or may not happen. You just need the mental health support there right from the get-go. But that's something quite simple, isn't it? And when you go to see the oncologist for the first time, is there a question on there? How is this person mentally coping? Is this person mentally okay? Just one question.
Yeah.
No.
And not just for cancer as well, not just any kind of traumatic experience.
Anything at all. That, I mean, even with me with the chronic pain, my chronic pain consultant, who has now retired, is the only consultant that's ever asked me how it's affected me. It's all focused on the physical side of things, as if we take our heads off, put it in a box, and then go off for our treatment physically. I've said this so many times. What affects us physically affects us mentally and vice versa. It's not even on the radar in the NHS, let alone ignored. I'm always campaigning about this.
Yeah.
And Melanie, you've just taken the words out of my mouth, because we know, you know, importantly through the work you do say, you know, what affects us mentally affects us physically, something that, you know, we're very conscious of as well. And in fact, going through this process, even with your mental health knowledge, eventually the stress of everything you were going through became too much. And in March 2021, you were diagnosed with PTSD and severe anxiety. Can you tell us about that stage?
Yeah, exactly that. So I thought I'd got it all together, which is what a lot of people say when they haven't. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with not having it all together. But my brain had not processed anything. It all happened so quickly. And that on top of the discharge, when I had my mastectomy, I was discharged with just paracetamol and ibuprofen. And if I tell you that I couldn't breathe without morphine, yeah, the pain was horrendous. I was sent home without adequate pain relief. So it was like being tortured all night in pain. So when I tried to find out about my reconstruction, because I didn't opt for an implant, I opted for a DEP reconstruction, where they take some of your tummy and they make a new breast, which is absolutely fascinating. And I'd been told initially nobody waits more than 18 months. So when it came to March and I'd been on the waiting list 6 months or so, I thought, I phoned and asked where I was. Is it going to be another 6 months? Is it going to be a year? And I was told it's not going to be at all. It's going to be 3, 4, possibly longer, because of COVID, because of all the things that were going on in the NHS, waiting lists had all been stopped, blah, blah. And it was at that point that I just had what I can only describe as a complete breakdown. And I think my brain was just going point to point to point to point to point. I may have had a breakdown anyway when I got past the reconstruction, but this was just, that was it. It sent me off and I was just a complete wreck. And I contacted Steps to Wellbeing, which is our local IAP service for mental health. I was diagnosed with PTSD and high anxiety. The only thing they could offer me was a group session online for PTSD stabilization.
You mentioned obviously this therapy was online. I'm wondering how much came into play that you were living in a rural area and being able to access services. Did that add to what you were going through at the time?
Absolutely. So I found it very frustrating that there were groups when we came out of lockdown face to face, but they were too far away from me and they were in the larger towns and cities, which is generally what happens with any sort of mental health peer support groups. So I really had no choice but to go online, which I'm grateful for it. But I think when I subsequently had another round of talking therapies while I was waiting for the PTSD therapy, and when I had another round of that was face to face, and that I found that much better for me.
Melanie, I just want to thank you for sharing your story with us so far. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, as I say, we're going to talk more about some of the issues people face when they're trying to access mental health support, particularly in rural areas, and about the work you're doing. Before then, we're going to play another track. You've chosen a few tracks for us to play today. This particular one is by Oasis and Champagne Supernova. Can you tell us why this song is special to you?
Yeah, this was the song that was playing when I was coming back from my oncology appointment with an oncologist had told me those words. Oh, sorry, your breast is with cancer and you're going to need a mastectomy. I thought I was going to die. So that's always been my favourite Oasis song. It's always been uplifting. But I remember just sort of trying to tell my brain to sing it because I'm going to be okay. But I was just quiet and it was sunny and I was looking up at the sky and just went with the song. And it was just very, very overwhelming for me.
So it's got real, real mixed emotions for you. Yeah. Well, look, let's take a break. Let's listen to Champagne Supernova by Oasis and we'll be back with Melanie right after this break.
This is Yawa Radio.
Hi, it's Zoe Bishop here, presenter of Feel Good Friday, every Friday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. I'd love you to join me if you like well-being tips, positivity, and fantastic tracks. You'll love listening.
This is Yawa Radio.
Welcome back. This week, we're speaking with our guest, Melanie Costas, founder and CEO of Rural Mental Health Matters. Melanie, before the break, you were talking about some of the issues you've experienced personally, and including accessing support services for your physical and mental health whilst living in a rural community. What kind of problems are you hearing from other people in this respect?
Statistically, Dorset, the county that I live in, 46% of the population live in a rural community. And generally, that's a lot higher than the whole of the UK, which is around 1 in 5 people, 12 million people living in rural communities in the UK, which really surprises some people because they think it's much lower. And when I started looking at the support that was around in Dorset, I went and spoke to a lot of people in different areas. And we did a survey with these people, and 75% of people felt that there was an inequality in rural versus urban support, which didn't surprise us really. And we had lots of people saying things like they feel unseen, they feel unheard, they feel unimportant, because when people don't see a service, they generally believe it doesn't exist. And therefore what happens is people don't tend to come forward until they're either at or approaching crisis. And as we know with suicide, sadly, that's too late. And I've learned through the communities that I'm involved with that even suicides with farmers aren't necessarily recorded as a suicide because of the insurance side, which is shocking. If a farmer takes their own life, it's often recorded as accident with a shotgun, accident with machinery, because the insurance won't cover it if it's a suicide. So the family are kind of left in this cloud, which is really horrendous.
What are some of the changes you think need to happen?
So let's take carers, for example. Carers don't seem to have any support in rural areas. They're just left to get on with it. I think that if they knew that there was support there for them, then there wouldn't be so much pressure on them. And when I'm talking about carers, I'm talking about mums, dads, wives, brothers, sisters, neighbours, anybody that relies on somebody else. I think what needs to be done is organisations need to look at the area that they cover and think, how do people rurally get to us? Just to be more rurally inclusive. You know, it doesn't mean that we put a service in every single town and village, but it could be that they could do an outreach, a satellite in a village hall, or, you know, even if it's once a month, just something, because the services are not equitable.
Just thinking about the statistics there and the rural versus urban split. Now, we, in our analysis, our critique of the national strategy, have highlighted some of the traps and fundamental flaws in there, you know, the top-down trap where it all comes down from national government and tells local areas what the problems are, which obviously is a major flaw. The priority trap where they prioritise certain groups over other groups, and the data and evidence trap where they only do anything if they've got data. So you just highlighted something really important there, that they don't publish this data. And I've worked with ONS, and they could do an analysis of the data by rural and urban. Probably take them about a day, maybe an afternoon, to do that analysis. Why do we not have that data, do you think?
I was invited to the committee's public inquiry into rural mental health back in April 2022. So EFRA, the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Committee. And that's obviously all MPs from all parties. And that was one of the things I raised. There's no accountability and there's no stats and data there that tells us the true picture. There's just regional and local areas and people like, there's no national body really overseeing it. And that's one of the things that I called for, the accountability, and so that we actually know what the picture is on the ground. We know that it will be different in different regions, but overall, the sense of isolation of living in rural areas will be the same. The feeling of being cut off, the problems with the public transport networks, fuel costs, the cost of living has a massive impact on people in rural areas because they have to put more fuel in the car and they have to travel further. So the wear and tear on their cars, and that's even if you can afford a car, because families on low income are completely isolated because they're reliant on the public transport system that is non-existent.
I just wondered what your thoughts were on stigma, Melanie. Do you think it's more prevalent in rural communities? So maybe a rural resident's more susceptible to it if they're in sort of small communities where everyone might know each other? Or do you think it's actually the opposite? Do you think they might receive better support from the community because there is more of a small knit?
That's a very interesting question. So that's one of the questions I was asked by one of the MPs, Barry Gardner, at the inquiry, because I was talking about the Wellness on Wheels, the mobile outreach that Rural Mental Health Matters would like to see across the country. So it's like a bus or a vehicle that goes out to people, and it's like a pop-up cafe. It won't have mental health spread all over it. And Barry's question to me was, will that not be used? Will people not whisper to each other and say, Fred's going to the bus? And I said the opposite, because it will be a welcoming place where people can come and connect with each other. And actually having those conversations reduces that stigma. But I think in the absence of support, the stigma is greater. Because when I was struggling with my mental health and I didn't see a service local to me, you then start to think, well, it must just be me then. I must be the only one feeling like this. So therefore, you sort of keep quiet longer and you keep things to yourself and you don't really want to bother people, or you might feel judged.
I think it's really interesting, Melanie, what you've said. You know, if people don't see support, they don't think it exists. But where they do see it and see others using it, they're likely to be more encouraged to use it as well, which I think is fascinating. You set up Rural Mental Health Matters Limited in 2019. Tell us about the mission and the work you do.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so I did that because of the fact that there was a lot of mental health support, well, a lot more in larger towns and cities. And there's a tendency, as even when services are providing a support for a region, an area, or even nationwide, they do that. They do set up in larger towns and cities. But the problem has been that since we've had a massive impact on public transport and rising cost of fuel, people that live in the rural communities, which is around 12 million in the UK, which is quite a significant amount, find it really, really challenging. And there's massive challenges and barriers to accessing support. Things like access to public transport, little to none, and the fact that it's hours and, you know, miles to get to these places, if they can even get there at all. So Rural Mental Health Matters was really started, we founded it in Dorset, but we've soon realised that even though Dorset has a 46% rural population, the challenges that Dorset residents face accessing support is mirrored and reflected nationally. So our mission and aims, to answer your question, is that we provide a more equitable, inclusive and accessible service that's visible in rural communities. That's what our vision is. And our mission, obviously, is then to provide earlier support to people that struggle because of the isolation and the ruralness.
Melanie, I'd like to ask you just your view on this issue of resilience. We often find that rural communities are discriminated against because people think they're more resilient than people living in towns and cities.
People do need help. they're tending to be more on the crisis side before they get the help. And I don't really consider that as a resilient community. There needs to be early intervention and early support. I don't think people have got a choice. I think that's probably more of the way that I would phrase it.
Do you think other people not living in rural communities, like MPs and so on, do you think they assume that people in rural communities are more resilient and need less?
Yeah, that tells you, doesn't it, with the answer that when the government were presented with a report from the inquiry into rural mental health, that their answer was rural communities have got everything they need and they're fine. So, yeah, there is an assumption there that everything's fine and the countryside is a nurturing nature. And what they don't actually realise is that the great outdoors, as I put it, is mostly inaccessible to people like me with disabilities. So the answer to your question about resilience, there's an assumption there that people living in rural areas have a lovely outlook. It's all calm and healing, when actually it can feel the opposite. It can feel like a prison, and assumptions kill people at the end of the day.
I think that's a really important point to sadly end up conversation with you, Melanie, but thank you for opening our eyes, really. I think many people's eyes that will be listening today to some of the challenges in these idyllic parts of the world, as many people outside may well see them. We're going to make sure that in the show notes on the website that we put the links to Rural Health Matters so people can find you there. But look, we always like to end our conversations with our guests by asking them to share a message of hope. And I suppose if you were speaking to someone who's living in a rural or isolated setting and they're struggling as you were to access support, what would your message of hope be for them?
So you can feel like you are the only person in a rural area that is struggling with their mental health. If you were to just go out, have a walk into town, go to the coffee shop, you're seeing another person's face smile at you. That's the connection there is just so important. And there's also the hub of hope. So just because you don't see services in your local area, it doesn't necessarily mean they don't exist. It's just a perception. So you can search by postcode on the hub of hope for things that are going on in your local community. Also, the libraries are a good source of information, community boards in your supermarket. There'll be little groups going on that you didn't even know about and you can just pop along to. And then, yeah, going online and having a look at the Hub of Hope. And there's lots of resources on our website, which is ruralmentalhealthmatters.co.uk, where you can find support.
Well, look, we're going to make sure we do signpost to those resources and to the Hub of Hope as well. We'll make sure we include that there. Look, before we let you go, we've been playing a few songs, but the next one we're going to play is Happy by Pharrell Williams. Tell us a little bit about why this song's special.
Okay, so my daughter lives in Portugal and I haven't seen her for a long time. Can you imagine? COVID, lockdown, and my daughter came over and we had street parties. Was it either the Queen's birthday or the Jubilee? And we were all out and it just felt really uplifting. And my daughter's got this sort of boom box and we stuck it on top of the wheelie bin and we played that. And everyone was dancing in the street. It was just such an uplifting experience. You can't help but smile when you hear this song.
It is a great song. Melanie, thank you so much for joining us today. And we're going to be right back with Danny and Paul in a few moments to round up our conversation today. And before then, let's listen to Pharrell Williams and Happy.
Now, did you know more and more people are starting the day the Yawa Breakfast way? Why don't you join me for breakfast from 7 a.m. right through till 11 a.m. every day of the week on Yawa Radio. We are your truly well-being and happiness station. Why not start your day by bringing the feel-good feeling to every day? Join me for Yawa Breakfast from 7 a.m. every day of the week.
This is Yawa Radio.
Welcome back. Well, Danny and Paul, I've certainly had my eyes opened a little bit on today's show about some of the challenges faced with living in more isolated and rural areas. And Danny, just wondering what were some of the key things you took away from our conversation with Melanie?
Yeah, I think Melanie's story really highlights the link between physical and mental pain. And when the right mental health support isn't in place or there's no mental health support at all, this can really have a detrimental effect on on people's ability to cope and how this can particularly affect those in rural areas where we know it's much more difficult for people to get the help they need.
I think you're right. I think, you know, for me, it almost seems mind-boggling, even though we've worked in this space for so long, that when someone's going to receive such traumatic news, that there isn't any kind of signposting on a letter or in a conversation to any kind of mental health support there. Paul, how about you? What came across for you?
Yeah, well, there's that point, isn't it? We often talk about the systems change, and there's an example. It's not that hard. And so there's so many counselling services available and growing nationally now, from their kind of local and regional base, that it's just a line in a standard letter. And then also Melanie outlining the problems with the NHS. We've known this for many years. They're just the bias against physical, the poor communication skills. And I was also thinking, as Melanie was talking about, she used the term assumptions kill people. And I thought, we can add that to the list, can't we? Say that, you know, competition kills people, low ambition kills people, you know, loneliness kills people, and poor communications kills people. And now there's another one, assumptions kills people. If the government and everybody else assumes that everybody's all right in rural areas, they're resilient, they don't need anything, any more support, they've got everything they need, you know, you're actually condemning people to this life. But it was great that she talked about all the things that are being done, the things that are available. Clearly, you know, a three-hour bus ride to some of these things, but more online. And she emphasised the Hub of Hope. So it was quite funny. We started the programme talking about the Hub of Hope being a great service, and Melanie talked about it. So let's end the programme. So, yeah, the Hub of Hope is a great service, but obviously we need to keep getting more services in there. And anything that's available in rural areas, people need to actually contact the Hub of Hope if there's anything that isn't in there, and get it in there as well, and make sure it's as comprehensive as possible.
Yeah, totally agree, Paul. And just coming back to a brief point I mentioned when chatting with Melanie as well, was that, you know, if people don't see the service, to them it doesn't exist. And I think this applies in workplaces, in schools, in our communities, about more clearer signposting to mental health services as well. Well, that's it for another episode of Jordan Space. My thanks to Danny and Paul, and to this week's guest, Melanie Kostas, of course. Thank you also for tuning in. I hope you found today's discussion interesting and insightful, as always. And if you felt inspired to support our work to help prevent suicides, you can make a donation on our website, thejordanlegacy.com, or you can get in touch with us directly by emailing hello@thejordanlegacy.com. You can engage with us on social media by following the Jordan Legacy CIC's LinkedIn company page. We're also on X, formerly known as Twitter, and Instagram using the username @JordanLegacyUK. Of course, we're also on Facebook at the Jordan Legacy. You can listen to recordings of previous shows on our website by choosing the menu Jordan Space at the top of our homepage. For now, and from Danny, Paul and myself, we'd like to wish you, as always, a safe, healthy and above all, hopeful rest of your week. And we're going to leave you with one final track chosen by Melanie, and that is Just the Way You Are by Bruno Mars.
This is Yawa Radio.
A big thank you for taking the time out to listen to this podcast from the team at Yawa Radio. Remember to check us out live online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at yawaradio.co.uk. And if you'd like to join us as a guest on Yawa Radio or as a guest on the Yawa Radio podcast, we would love to hear from you. Simply email studio@yawaradio.co.uk. Once again, a big thank you for taking the time out to listen. This is the Yawa Radio podcast. Copyright applies.